In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Welcome to the Voice of Russia and its weekend program, The Red Line. Every weekend, we, Sergei Strok and Dmitry Polikarpov and Ekaterina Kudashkina, invite you to discuss the most significant events of the week. We are joined by Russian and international experts, politicians, scientists and artists who are sharing or opposing our views on the vast and increasingly interdependent world shared by all of us.
We want our program to be personal, provocative and fair.
So this week, we shall focus on the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's visit to Syria. We shall once again look at the prospects for President Assad, his people and the region. We shall then travel just across the border and take a closer look at how the Palestinian reconciliation process goes against the backdrop of unprecedented paradigm shifts altering the Middle East political landscape. And then we shall move on to evaluate democratic transformation in this country, Russia, and analyze just how instrumental have the protests been in bringing in more change to our lives. So, does that sound fair enough to you this week, Dima?
Yes, I think you have just mentioned the key issues.
The key issue to me looks like paradigm shifts, I believe.
Yes.
Which are requiring a certain change in perception, change in thinking in Western countries too.
Yes, but look, you announced that Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visit to Damascus. And in the final part of the program, we are supposed to discuss Russia's politics, upcoming presidential elections. And I think that Russia's position on Syria is also determined by internal political agenda here. That's why I believe all those events somehow are interlinked.
Well, I think that what binds them together is, like I said, a need of new thinking and new approaches and new prospects to be adopted by the West. And we can very well see that in relation to some Middle East countries and rather to some political organizations in the Middle East, the West is already demonstrating a change in approach. I'm referring to Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, for instance.
But at the same time, inertia of all thinking, of all approaches, is still to a large extent determining world politics.
But inertia is devastating. So I suggest we could now move to the first section of our program, Between the Lines, in which, for the second time running, we are going to discuss the escalating Syrian crisis and try to understand its domestic and international implications. We shall have to focus on the ongoing controversy over the recent Russian-Chinese veto on the UN Security Council resolution and try to give some insight into the blitz visit to Damascus, which was paid by Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, and by the way, which is very important, the head of Russia's intelligence service, Mikhail Fradkov.
You know, Katya, to be frank, when we sat in the studio last week, I couldn't have imagined that we'll have to speak about Syria the week after. But you're absolutely right. There's no escape from Syria these days.
By the way, I remember that last time when we were discussing Syrian story, you had an impression that all sides were bridging their positions. And you were saying that the resolution is going to be finally passed.
So you want me to eat my words?
Would you be able to do so?
Well, Katya, but you must understand that initial understanding was that all sides will study the draft resolution for at least several days to iron down remaining differences. So the dominant mood was that we are coming closer to compromise.
Well, true. But now, talking of compromise, if you remember, Mr. Lavrov was explaining that he was asking the Security Council, he was telling them not to put the draft resolution on vote before his visit to Damascus. But strangely enough, the vote was there before Lavrov went to Damascus, so I don't think that in this case anyone should be surprised about Russian and Chinese veto.
Well, this is very interesting development you are referring to. In fact, this week it was revealed due to some diplomatic leaks from Moscow that really there was unofficial understanding. I want to emphasize this unofficial understanding that Americans will not go ahead with this draft resolution before Mr. Fradkov and Mr. Lavrov go to Damascus. But then all of a sudden, due to the reason unknown to me and all of us here, we can only guess, the resolution was hastily passed to the Security Council. And that left a Russian delegation with no option, just to say no.
Okay, so then the logic goes, who is to be blamed for the failing of the second draft? Obviously, those are not Russia and China.
Well, the last thing I want is just to find who has to be blamed.
Well, that's not the topic, of course, Sergei. But anyway, now everyone tends to put the blame on Russia and China. So, just an off-topic, it is not fair. But, Dima, I thought you were trying to tell us something.
Yes, I really do not understand why they decided finally to put the resolution. To me, it was a surprise. Maybe what Sergei is saying, that they just wanted to see, once again, Russia and China's double veto. I can't explain it, because the result was obvious, so to say, beforehand.
There was some hidden agenda, which is not known to us. Yeah. But that spoiled the whole thing.
Some kind of bargaining?
Probably is.
Well, I think that there are several layers to this situation.
I would say some kind of pressure.
You're listening to Redline in the World Service of the Voice of Russia.
Well, anyway, Mr. Lavrov and Mr. Fradkov were accorded, as we well know, warm welcome in Damascus, which came as a nice contrast with the UN Security Council discussions, I suppose.
Well, Katya, really, when I've seen those scenes of thousands of people, enthusiastic peoples, President Assad's loyalists who were waving Russian tricolors at the streets of Damascus, I thought that this is what all of us probably could have hardly expected. Because the initial belief was that embattled Syrian leader enjoys no more popular support, that he and his supporters are on the last legs, and the regime is on the brink of collapse. So all that outburst of enthusiasm, if we can call it this way, was really surprising to us. But coming back to what happened in the United Nations Security Council headquarters, knowing that the resolution was rushed in so, well, unexpected way to us.
Indecent way.
So I think this is a logical result. It comes as no surprise to me, though I'm surprised that really the both sides were not able to come to a compromise.
Now, I'm sure that while scanning news wires, you, Sergei and Dima, have come across a very interesting number. So according to a recent study, recent survey by one of the independent Arab agencies, Assad is enjoying 55% support. 55% support. Well, that's a... In all democracies, this is considered a very good result.
This is more than half.
This is more than half.
But at the same time, these figures show that the country is split.
Well,
split into
to an extent, if you remember the first victory of President George W. Bush, the figure was less. But still,
he became the
president of the United States.
But I think both of you will agree that the double veto imposed on the new Security Council resolution on Syria last Saturday made all of us, regardless of whether we support this move or denounce it, we really experienced a distinct sense of déjà vu. Do you agree with me?
Yes, already last time we were speaking about déjà vu in the way how the discussion was evolving. But
I suppose it's another indicator that we are growing old. Everything to us is becoming a déjà vu these days.
Look.
It's called the experience.
Well, don't sound, please, too philosophical. It looks as if it was a real déjà vu, Katya, as Russia and China have already vetoed another Security Council resolution dated back to last October, which was condemning President Assad's use of force.
Well, and this time Russia no to the new draft resolution really evoked something like political tsunami, all sorts of cries.
And this is a different moment.
How come?
I mean, last October there was no such an enormous outcry.
Well, but this time the outcry is not constructive, really. It's more emotional. And by the way, this makes me wonder, because the emotional reactions are so very often indicative of a lack of substantiative position. Wouldn't you agree?
Katya, I think you have a point, and let me add to this that emotions running high are also an indication of a deadlock, as I see it.
Well, true. You know, it's interesting that some analysts are even trying to compare this situation with something no less than Suez Crisis of 1956, when Moscow had locked horns with the West over Egypt in a classic scenario of the Cold War standoff.
Well, Suez Crisis of 56, this is almost forgotten moment of that period.
Well, too bad, because we need to remember.
Yeah, but, you know, I can hardly agree this is something similar to Suez Crisis as such. However, today, nearly 60 years later, Cold War has gone into history, and the bone of contention is Syria. And it is getting pretty tense as the latest attempt to endorse a roadmap for Syrian settlement, which was proposed by the Western powers and Arab leagues under the umbrella of Security Council, failed.
And all eyes were focused on Russia.
Which is a wrong direction, like we already said.
Well, Russia's position was largely seen as a major roadblock to all embracing the settlement after this using veto right for the second
time. Well, yes, of course. Yes, of course, because there is always Russia to be blamed for everything, of course. It was not their haste that foiled all the attempts to reach an agreement. But anyway, French President Nicolas Sarkozy called it a scandal. He was saying something about a disobedient Russia, and he was pledging to raise the issue in his talk with President Medvedev. But I'm not sure that he succeeded in bringing his point home to Mr. Medvedev during the telephone talk.
Well, Katya, it was not only President Sarkozy. Regrettably, that was a dominant mood in the Security Council. And
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, I'm not surprised as well. And Mr. Sarkozy was echoed by State Secretary Clinton and other ranking political and diplomatic figures from both the West and the Arab world. They viewed Russian position as, how they call it, a betrayal of the Syrian people.
Meantime, commenting on the outcry over the veto on the eve of his visit to Damascus, Minister Lavrov fired back, calling it indecent and almost hysterical.
Well, I suppose he has a point, though.
Well, those expressions, indecent and almost hysterical, underscore the degree of tension in the Security Council. But, friends, let me share with you some general observations. I was thinking of it these days, so I came to understanding that while we are living in a post-Cold War world, the barricades of the Cold War are replaced with the new invisible lines. Let me stress it, the lines are invisible. And they are not only divided in the Middle East, they divide the whole world into the zones of interests and areas of influence. And you know, you can never find those zones, those areas on the world map, but they exist.
Well, you know, Sergei, I'm afraid this is really not big news since the start of the colonial era some centuries ago. But anyway, so what's your point? I know you're a poet,
Well, well, my point is that politics and economy are tied into a Gordian knot along with the security and humanitarian issues. And my point is that in situation like this, the real motivation of the major players and the logic behind their moves is often misinterpreted and misunderstood, and this is what we see with Syria.
Well, that's what usually is described as conspiracy theory. And but my point is, like you
Not a conspiracy theory.
This those are covered politics, and this is absolutely natural because not everything is made known. I believe that's a natural development of political events. It's nothing new. My point is that those who actually scorn at the expression of conspiracy theory don't really have a point, because that's what the politics is all about.
Well, I can't fully agree that this is really something related to conspiracy theories, for simple reason that, according to me, conspiracy theories is something irrational, whereas hidden agenda is something more than rational. But you never know what is the hidden agenda
What's
of this or that state.
What's the difference between conspiracy theories, between the idiom of conspiracy theory and hidden agenda? Just the connotation is different, because conspiracy theories is something which is allegedly engaging some kind of psychologically unstable people. But otherwise, it's just the hidden agenda, isn't it?
Not to go too far into discussion.
In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
I want to tell you that conspiracy theory is one of the way of simplistic approach to world politics. This is an attempt just to say that you become a subject of conspiracy or from some outside force. Whereas hidden agenda is something which is not openly spelled out by this or that country. But this can be a real motivation of the moves of the major world players.
Well, speaking about how to say...
What's the difference between hidden agenda and conspiracy theory?
Sergei better knows it, but I'm...
Oh, really?
What is your point?
Do we have a spy sitting next to us in the studio?
I would say I'm rather rational than irrational person. So that's why I think that Russia has plenty of reasons to support Mr. Assad to the last moment. I mean, I would say at least 5 or 6 reasons. Obviously.
No, Dima, this time our discussion was rather theoretical. Just what is the difference between hidden agenda and a conspiracy theory? What is the essential difference?
I think it's a question of bias, something like
so, Dima,
more linguistics
my position,
than politics.
Sergei. But anyway, getting back to Syria and to Russia's role. So is Russia's present-day no on Syria? Doesn't it remind you somehow of the Soviet foreign minister's Andrei Gromyko famous нет?
And he was known as Mr. Net in the West.
He was known as Mr. Net. Or do you think that perhaps Russia really behaves like, I don't know, a teenager driven by some kind of egoism, but not a responsible global power? So this is a reproach that's been voiced by Western powers.
To put it bluntly, has Russia really betrayed Syrian people? Do you believe it?
Well, and if so, then who would be those people who were welcoming Lavrov and Fradkov? And who would be those 55% that are supporting Mr. Assad?
So I think that visit of two Russian top envoys to Damascus also revealed some part of the truth which was not disclosed till this week. But
has it been disclosed this week, Sergei?
It was disclosed after the visit when we see that welcome and how the visit was conducted. But let me tell you how I see it, you know. Even if their mission fails, I think that the world must thank Mr. Lavrov and Mr. Fradkov for making decent last-minute effort to set in motion the defunct mechanism of political settlement. And their effort is largely distorted, misinterpreted, and misunderstood, as I said. But look, at any rate, they didn't come home empty-handed.
Well, yes, of course, because from what Mr. Lavrov told the reporters, President Assad has once again reiterated his readiness to talks with the opposition, and he also pledged to follow the Arab League's plan. And by the way, he also said that in the coming days he would come up with the dates of the constitution referendum.
Look, and all those things came out of less than 24-hour visit. And moreover, according to Mr. Lavrov, President Assad also committed to end violence and to hold referendum on the new constitution. And as you know, the point of the referendum is a key point of much-needed democratic reform in Syria.
But just a small remark. I suppose that Mr. Assad has been saying it time and again, but like we said in the previous program, he was just not heard. And Mr. Lavrov's visit just made it possible for him to be heard. So is my understanding correct, Dima?
Yes, I agree with you, because the problem, how to say, the part has been refusing to negotiate was the opposition, obviously. Because the opposition several times that it was not going to negotiate.
And they're repeating that.
Yes.
I mean, so once again, we're coming to the same old situation now involving Assad. So who is to blame for the lack of negotiations?
Because the opposition puts as a precondition, Assad's retirement, resignation.
That's right.
It's really an obstacle.
By the way, when we're talking about Syrian opposition, we should once again stress that it is so fractured. It is absolutely disunited. It does not speak in one voice.
So,
if we talk about toppling President Assad, there is no one become an efficient leader in this country.
The problem is that the opposition has nothing to negotiate. The only thing the opposition wants is to make Assad to step down. So what kind of negotiations?
Which means that it does not really care for those large numbers of killed people.
They want a change of power, obviously.
They're prepared to plunge the war deeper into the civil war.
Yes, friends,
I would like to ask you, does it give us at least a weak glimmer of hope that the country would avert the scenario of civil war, do you believe?
I would say more precisely, would avert the scenario of the deterioration of civil war, because the civil war obviously is already there.
Yes, Europeans at least, they think so.
By the way, sorry, Dima, for interrupting you. Sergei, how would you comment on the special forces from the UK and Qatar already operating in the territory of Syria?
Well, those reports are not yet confirmed.
Oh, yes, they are.
Really? So I believe this is very unfortunate development, this undermines the very idea of
international law.
Yes, and it also undermines the very idea of the inter-Syrian dialogue. So the idea that this is the internal problem which has to be settled inside Syria by Syrians themselves.
Aren't we already talking about some kind of professional military involvement of third parties in the domestic Syrian conflict?
Again, if those reports are confirmed, definitely I will say that the situation is evolving in that way you're referring to. So, and this is an unfortunate development. The West is stirring up opposition and...
It's financing opposition.
Yes, opposition. And it seems that this actually can nullify the results of the visit of two Russian envoys to Damascus.
But that brings us to another conclusion, that no one really wants the end of the civil war. What they're all after is the toppling of Assad, whatever price it takes. no one is really concerned with the loss of lives. That's an awful hypocrisy.
What I see is just there's definite attempt to turn Security Council into a sort of an instrument of toppling leaders, introducing regime change. And if Security Council doesn't work, if veto right is used, then, as we see, there are another international instruments to rock the boat, to upset the situation, and to oust legitimate leader from power.
Well, true.
Well, colleagues, I can see at least one more serious problem. I refer to the fact that the bitter irony is that it is not only the Western powers, but also President Assad who often misinterpreted Moscow's initiatives.
How come?
It's an open secret that earlier he has already made commitments to stop crackdown on the opposition and backtrack on the issue.
Well, Dima, as for Assad, I think that his main problem at this point is that he has interpreted Russia's Security Council veto and Russia's officials' visit to Damascus as a sign of an unequivocal support, as a sign of solidarity with his regime. And this is a problem because the purpose of the visit was just to explain him that he also has to stop that crackdown on opposition.
I'm so sorry, Sergei, but as a head of state, he's responsible for the security situation there. I understand and I subscribe to that. Both parties to the conflict.
Both parties, yes.
Both parties to the conflict are engaged in violence. But on the other hand, when those armed groups operating against the government, do you know any government that would not adhere to armed opposition to those groups in that situation?
The crackdown in Syria, as I understand it, according to sources I am referring to, so that crackdown on Syrian opposition, brutal crackdown, started already when they were armless people peacefully protesting at the streets.
By the way, Sergei, what are the sources you're quoting?
I am quoting leading Western sources. Credible British media.
Okay, and now I suggest
I
we could listen to Aisling Byrne coming to us from Beirut with an update of the recent developments in Syria.
What we're seeing in wake of the Russian and Chinese veto at the UN, I think what was to be expected before the veto was that there would be a real push by the propaganda sides of working with the Syrian opposition to show that there might have been a massacre going to happen and it was going to be expected. And I think this is another example of actually the propaganda effort that's put into this war on Syria. And if you look carefully at the figures, even figures that come from the opposition sources themselves, the local coordination committees, who are one of the main sources quoted in the press widely, their figures vary very much. So on the 4th of February, for example, they first claimed 200 people killed. They then confirmed actually it was 55 people. On the 6th of February, some activist groups said 50 and other people said 12. So I think you have to be very careful about the claims that are coming out of Homs. There's clearly some kind of operation underway. The Syrian Ministry of Interior have said that they've killed dozens of armed militants. A lot of people have been arrested, they've said, after surrendering. They've seized large caches of arms and various other equipment. But I think a lot of the claims, particularly of the families being killed, there's a lot of claims and counterclaims, and these have to be taken very carefully. There are reports from Homs that, you know, there's wild exaggeration going on. And yet when you read certain press outlets, particularly those siding with the opposition and pushing for regime change in Syria, who quote solely opposition sources, you get a very different picture from if you take a very broad reading of all a wide variety of sources, including Syrian sources, other international media, and particularly non-Western media, who have correspondents on the ground, who give a very different picture to what's been presented in the media.
And that was Aisling Byrne, Projects Coordinator with Conflicts Forum.
You're tuned in to the Voice of Russia.
This is Red Line. And now we're moving to the next section of our program, Between the Lines, in which we discuss press pieces with a fresh look at important international events. And this time it's going to be a Christian Science Monitor editorial of the 8th of February entitled Talk to Hamas? Talk to Taliban? Thank the Arab Spring for those possibilities. Now, are you intrigued?
In fact, yes, I could have never expected such a catchy title. Hamas is there, Taliban is there, and Arab Spring is there.
Well, true.
Congratulations to Christian Science Monitor editors.
Yes, absolutely.
Looks like a media cocktail.
A media cocktail.
Yes.
But anyway, that makes a good transition from Syria to what we are going to discuss now. And now a brief outline of what it is all about. So this week, an agreement was signed in Qatar by the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and the exiled Hamas leader Khaled Mashal. And the agreement is part of a reconciliation process which was formally launched in May 2011 in Egypt. So the Doha deal signed this week embraces part of this process, focusing on creating a Palestinian unity government that would oversee the rebuilding of Gaza and preparation for the Palestinian presidential and parliamentary election. And the interim government will be headed by no one else but Mahmoud Abbas, who is also the leader of Fatah movement, which is Hamas' old rival. So Hamas, on the other hand, is still on the terrorist group's list in Israel, United States, and the European Union. And that is where we stand and where the whole controversy lies. And that's what we are going to discuss in this piece.
Oh, really? There's more than one aspect to the situation, is there?
Well, the usual Middle East mix. And how about the opening quote, Katya?
Oh, sure. It's a long one, but I'm sure you will not mind that. The Arab Spring's main message, that young people seek self-governance and dignity through peaceful means, continues to bestow surprising gifts in the region. One is that radical Islamists are being forced to radically rethink their approach. And Dima Sergei, please remember this point, okay? We'll get to that later. So, to carry on with the quote, the dawn of democracy in Egypt, for example, has pushed the Muslim Brotherhood to moderate its hardline ways to the point that Ann Patterson, the U.S. ambassador to Cairo, was able to meet with the group last month after years of Washington keeping an arm's length. The Taliban of Afghanistan, meanwhile, has set up an office in the tiny Gulf Kingdom of Qatar and reportedly met with an American representative in recent days to pursue peace talks. And Hamas, which is the Islamic group that has ruled Palestinian territory in the Gaza Strip since the year of 2000, agreed this week to reconcile with its rival on the West Bank, which is Fatah. So, and now my question to you, Dima and Sergei, is just how accurate do you think is the assessment that radical Islamists are forced to rethink their approach?
First of all, Katya, just a follow-up to what you said over that Qatar turning into headquarters for the Taliban movement.
That's not me. It was the quote from the Christian Science Monitor.
Yes, that's what I'm saying is that I was very much surprised to learn that this week the last representatives of Hamas left Damascus. So they're not stationed anymore in Syria.
And, but I suppose that Khaled Mashal left Damascus with the onset of the current unrest. It was something like a year ago.
That's right. But they wasn't there.
Well, they had a very small office there.
What is there? But now there are reports that probably they will move to Qatar as well. And if those reports...
What does that signify?
And look,
what does that imply?
Look, that's what you're saying, that the situation is changing and Qatar can become just a homeland, you know, for Taliban fighters.
But remember that Qatar is a country which is a close ally to the United States.
Yes. And it can be also the place for the headquarters of Hamas.
Does that mean that the United States is the world power which is encouraging, engaging those former terrorist groups with the mainstream policies in the region? Do you think that this could be the case?
That means a lot, obviously, but the main change is that really those radical Islamic forces are becoming more moderate. And the most textbook example of that transformation is Hamas, which has toned down its anti-Israeli rhetoric, which is now entering into negotiations with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas, and which agreed to give him that chair of the head of the interim government, in addition to his chair of the president of the Palestinian National Autonomy.
Sergei, it's interesting that this time you're sounding so optimistic that I suppose you're not taking some currents into account. Hamas is strongly split on the issue of the Doha deal.
That's right, but I want to be frank, you know, till this week I believed that Hamas is very, very much hardlined. That Hamas is a...
I remember you argued with me about that in our previous programs.
But still, I believe that Hamas was very persistent, very determined in spelling out its truth, how they understood it. and they were showing no signs of compromise. But then, all of a sudden, the situation changed, and what we see now comes as total surprise to me.
Are you saying they're giving up their principles?
It's not that. You know, I think they're becoming more flexible, probably more politically mature. They understand that in order to achieve some goals, they just have not only just to be well-versed with Kalashnikovs, granite launches, but they have to be also well-versed at the negotiating table.
What are their goals as you see them, Sergei?
Their goal was spelled out in one of the recent statements of Mr. Khaled Mashal, who said that they want to establish the Great Palestine. Great Palestine, which would be just a sort of...
Well, obviously...
A new power at the Middle East. And to achieve this ultimate goal, they're ready to make concessions.
Thank you, Sergei. Dima?
Well, colleagues, I can see at least one obvious reason which can make radical Islamists to rethink their approach. And I think that they see that they are closer now to getting into power in many countries.
If we remember that Hamas actually is translated like Islamic resistance, and that those organizations we are now referring to have emerged as part of Islamic resistance to the Western rule, then perhaps you have a point that those organizations no longer need to be radical. And Dima is correct while saying that if now they have an opportunity to come to power with peaceful means, they no longer need to be radical. But now we get to another question of their ideology. I mean, are you sure that they're going to renounce some points which many people in the street understand as a requirement for radical action?
I don't think they're going just to backtrack on the basic principles of their ideology. But at the same time, you use the word resistance. And the very word resistance...
That's what Hamas stands
yes,
for.
As I understand it, bears a certain degree of negativism, a certain degree of destruction, a certain degree of unwillingness to achieve compromise. But one thing is when you are in opposition, Dima is right, but when you come to power, then what comes is responsibility.
Now, let's see what's the Monitor editorial is saying to the effect. So, just another quote... The moderate Islamists see an opening too, as democracy takes roots in liberated Arab countries. Hopes are rising that the election of such groups to power will force them to deal with job creation and other secular needs, as Turkey's ruling Islamic party has discovered.
Well, but if it can be achieved not by bullet, by ballot, well, then what's the problem?
I suppose that this is a position shared by many Arab countries, because as far as I understand, many Arab countries have welcomed the development.
Well, this is certainly not the case with Israel, and Prime Minister Netanyahu was quite upset about the deal.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is saying Hamas is a terrorist organization which strives to destroy Israel and relies on support from Iran. Hamas and peace don't go together.
Well, he's not the only one to be so unhappy about the Doha deal. Because I've seen an opinion piece in the JewishPress.com to that effect, and it was entitled, Hamas Fatah Reconciliation, Another Nail in the Peace Coffin?
Look, but that is the inertia of the old approaches I was speaking from the very start of our program, as you remember.
That's right.
Yes, and I have no doubt that Israel is not going to talk to Hamas under any conditions.
Well, the UN Secretary General has said Palestinian reconciliation and the Middle East peace process should not contradict one another.
I envy our UN officials. I envy their ability to speak plain things without caring much how they actually translate into reality. But there are a lot of obstacles ahead.
And now on Redline, an expert opinion.
You could listen to our guest speaker, Gershon Boskin, who is describing the challenges of the reconciliation process.
How do you see the prospects of the deal that has been signed by Fatah and Hamas in Doha, in Qatar?
This is part of a long process that's been going on now for over a year, and they've made progress, but I'm not sure that the deal is completed yet.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they managed to agree that President Abbas would be the prime minister does not necessarily put all the pieces into place in order to make it work. They still have to decide on the government, which is not an easy task because we're talking about people who are serving in the West Bank government of Salam Fayyad, and people are serving in the Gaza government of Ismail Haniyeh, who are going to have to give up their positions and their power and their authority, and that's not such an easier thing to do. The other thing that's even more difficult is the reintegration of the security forces into one security force, which I don't know if will happen in the immediate future. Perhaps a new government will be established of technocrats whose job it is to prepare for new elections, and then once new elections take place, the winner will take all. Perhaps this is the agreement they worked out, but it's very unclear still how they plan to implement what they've agreed to.
Obviously, we could have expected that Hamas would be split on the issue. And Hamas parliamentarians are very angry. They're saying the deal is illegal.
And of course, they don't want to report to Abbas.
Oh, true. And the opposition within the Gaza parliament is very strong. Look, it is a parliamentary bloc, which is called Change and Reform, and it includes Hamas top leaders, Ismail Haniyeh and Mahmoud al-Zahar. They did not attend the ceremony in Qatar. And what is very important, they're based in Gaza. Unlike the Hamas political chief in exile, Khaled Mashal, who until last year was based in Damascus, like we already said, right?
So it's close, which makes Abbas both a president and prime minister for a future Palestinian government.
Which makes them angry? Well, now, this point is largely a legal discussion, because some are saying that would be absolutely unconstitutional, and others are saying that there is no legislation in the Palestinian law which imposes limitations on Mr. Abbas becoming both the prime minister while he is still a president of the Palestinian Authority. However, if you remember, Hamas enjoyed a landslide victory at the general election in 2006, in which it defeated Fatah.
No wonder they hate the idea of seeing Abbas as their prime minister now.
Yes, of course. And there's also another sensitive issue. Many people are afraid that under the deal, Hamas risks its jobs and its influence in Gaza.
And there's more to their rivalry than the 2006 election, isn't there?
Well, there have been rivals since Hamas was founded in 1988. And it is considered to be the largest Palestinian militant organization,
which ousted Fatah from Gaza in 2007, if we remember. There was something amounting to an armed conflict. And there's another thing. It is that Fatah was trying to negotiate with Israel, whereas Hamas used to reject all negotiations or two-state solution. And by the way, it was created as the Palestinian wing of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, you know.
So, could it be that Hamas, too, is going to follow the Egyptian colleagues, so to say?
Well, you know, to be fair, they already tried to curb the attacks on Israel from Gaza, if you remember.
That what I was saying, they're turning down their rhetoric and just they're trying to control themselves somehow.
Oh, that's right. But, you know, it's interesting. If we look at potential map of the Middle East, look, so there's Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt?
Yes.
There's high probability that there's going to be Muslim Brotherhood in Syria.
We discussed that.
Yes, in remote perspective, so to say. Because even if Mr. Assad stays, but even if there is election, Muslim Brotherhood is a considerable part of the Syrian society, is going to be included in is going to participate in the election, which, and there is a high probability that it gains at least some places in the parliament. So then there is Hamas coming to power in the Palestinian Authority, which is part of Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, Hamas is part of the Muslim Brotherhood system. There is the Turkish party, which is part of the Muslim Brotherhood, large family. Does that mean that we are going to have a belt of Muslim Brotherhood countries?
You mean Middle East Brotherhood?
Middle East Brotherhood?
I hope it would be moderate.
Well, we don't know, but one thing is clear, that the Middle East is never going to be the same, right?
I think the situation really is evolving in that way, and let us at least hope that Middle East Brotherhood would be the synonym to good neighborhood.
You're tuned to the Voice of Russia.
This is Red Line. And this week our man in the news is Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. He has been a real newsmaker during the last days.
Yes, Katya, we saw an avalanche of election pledges coming from him just a few days after another mass rally held by the opposition in Moscow.
Oh, true. Now, some of them came as a strong surprise, making analysts say that presentation of a new release of Russia's most influential politician is underway as voters prepare for the presidential elections slated for the 4th of March. And first, the Prime Minister published the fourth chapter of his extensive election program in the Kommersant Daily, and the campaign article entitled Democracy and the Quality of State surprisingly put forward some political reforms cherished by the non-parliamentary opposition. And then Russian voters were offered the hottest points of Mr. Putin's long-awaited election pledges list.
Okay, and may I ask you a question, colleagues?
Of course, Dima. You're always welcome to ask any questions and to say anything you wish.
Okay. My question is maybe a little bit surprising, but it's...
Paradoxical.
Not paradoxical.
That's the style of our program,
just to change, the serious bias of our discussion. So I would like to ask you, have you slept well during the last couple of months?
That sounds a little bit too personal, Dima.
Yes, but I mean just to add a free... fresh air to our serious political debates.
Uh-huh.
I mean, does it cost you to wake up this winter more than usually?
I have not felt any difference, Dima.
Well, that's an answer of a very healthy person.
You're a happy man, Sergei. You're a happy man.
You're really a happy man. Because
I am a happy man, yes.
I feel it very difficult to get up an hour earlier. I mean, when it is still dark at 9:30 in the morning, I do feel bad about that. So this winter has really, shall we say, put many of us on trial, because without traditional change to winter schedule, winter time, I do feel myself somewhat uncomfortable. Besides, when I have to call people in Europe, when I have to call people in other parts of the world. Now, we have the time difference 3 hours with Europe, which is really too much.
Yes, it's also an additional problem, I would say. But now you can make a wish, Katya. Putin addressed this topic together with several other painful issues which have been causing strong criticism towards the authorities.
Well, you know, I felt that someone is going to address the issue during the presidential campaign.
Yes, Dima, Mr. Putin has promised to turn back the clock and restore wintertime in Russia if elected president, addressing 2 million of angered voters who have complained about waking up and going to work in darkness. But I think probably this bears a certain metaphorical meaning. Presidential hopeful Putin as a person who is ready to restore time.
You know, extremely difficult to talk politics with poets. So, are you saying that Mr. Putin is going to come back to the Kremlin to turn back the clock? But really, I suppose this metaphor needs to be explained a little bit, to be elaborated. To turn the clock where? To more democracy from the somewhat difficult situation we're all in now, or...
Well, I would put it this way. There's no question of just, you know, giving more degree of democracy. I see it in different ways. I would call it making Russian democracy more mature, a Russian political system more flexible, and more ready to face the realities, changing realities of countries' development, with modernization drive remaining as one of the motors of its development.
And, you know, I'm sure that in, shall we say, a guarded international environment, someone would say that it's also an attempt to run against the time. But the environment is so strange, because when I was looking through, of course I've been looking through various news reports, and now I think that we're so used to criticism, both biased and unbiased, that we have failed to observe a very important moment. Now, when everybody, to be more precise, when so many Western analysts are following our protests here, we fail to remember that this kind of protests are part of democratic process in every democratic country. They are part of democratic election process.
But that's what I'm saying. This is the newly discovered signs of new maturity of Russia's political system.
That's it. And it does not indicate in any way that there's some kind of political crisis. It is not a necessary condition of political crisis.
I believe the problem is that we are not get used to this kind of protests. At least we spent like a decade without any protests. I mean,
okay,
visible
so
protests.
That's very good that we are getting used
that's
to.
That's why we see this protest as a political crisis, and maybe it's only a sort of political process better than crisis, I would
say. Well, democratic process and political maturity, like Sergei was saying.
And these days, the man in the news is Vladimir Putin, who is spelling out his, pre-election program. But look, how he is doing this. This time, The election campaign is different from the previous campaigns, and at this moment there's no, so to say, election program as such. He has done it in a more innovative way by publishing series of articles in leading Russian and Western
media.
So today we are discussing that Kommersant publication, which came out this week.
But there was also Vedomosti publication?
Yes, but before that there were publications in Vedomosti, business paper, and in Rossiyskaya Gazeta. So he was just able to make discussion week after week and involving more and more people from different factions of the society.
Yes,
not only those who support him, but also opponents. And now it turns out that the more we read his articles, we realize that he has taken some points from those people who believe to be his arch foes, his opponents, like Liberal Democratic Party
Sergei,
leader Yavlinsky.
That is natural. That was something to be expected because it is his brand style of discourse, of engaging people with some very, shall we say, with the details that are important to them. For instance, when he's talking to people in the street, he's addressing their own concerns, like the time, something Dima was telling us about.
By the way, I think Putin, who schedules most of his appointments for the afternoon, was among those who complained about the change.
The time change, you mean?
Yes, yes.
Interesting.
He acknowledged recently that he always finds it difficult to wake up. And by the way...
Well, something I was trying to say, that basing his discourse on addressing those small concerns people are voicing, he's got a good feeling for that. And by the way, do I get it right that even he discussed this issue with Medvedev? Huh?
Yes, yes, it seems that Medvedev is aware of upcoming possible change back. Because as Putin put it, Dmitry Anatolyevich will agree with this, how to say, change. If people want it, it will not going to be a problem.
I think, Dima, you have a point. And Putin's personal approach seems to be the core of his, so to say, amended image or new version of Putin. He apparently wants to show voters his more human side. And he wants to show them that he's able to address the hottest social issues instead of just ignoring them.
I will agree with you, Sergei, if the Prime Minister accepts the invitation to participate in the massive meeting in his support planned on February 23rd. It could be a very strong campaign move, signaling the birth of, so to say, a new Putin.
Well, I'm afraid that there are going to be skeptical voices saying that, well, look, some political analysts have already said that Putin's new ideas and proposals just pre-electoral populism, pure and simple.
This is the Voice of Russia. And now on Redline, an expert opinion.
Isn't it strange that, of all people, Mr. Putin would be the figure provoking so much both attention and belligerence in the West?
And this is the question we address to Vyacheslav Nikonov, president of Politico Foundation.
Well, of course, Putin is not the most popular figure in the West, unlike the rest of the globe. Putin is, by the way, quite popular in many countries, including China, India, Latin American countries, and so on. But, you know, and the West, of course, is not that united. There is Southern Europe where there are no strong emotions against Putin. It's mostly Anglo-Saxon world, of course, and mostly the United States, United Kingdom. Why they're dissatisfied? Because Putin represents an independent Russia with its own view on international affairs, which oftentimes does not coincide with those of the U.S. government or some other Western governments. Putin represents Russia, which has its own national interests and does not just follow the national interests of the others. And actually, there are not so many people like that. And I think that's why. Putin did not support the war in Iraq. He does not support the war in Afghanistan. He did not support the war in Libya. And he's definitely not supporting the possible coming wars with Syria or Iran, and that's exactly what the Western countries are up to. The legitimization of the presidential election may be good for those who want to see weak Putin rather than strong Putin, rather weak Russia and not strong Russia. So that's the logic.
But you know what is the main slogan of that pro-Putin rallies?
Pro-Putin rallies?
Yes, that's right. If not Putin, then who? And really, this is the question street opposition is unable to answer. There's no alternative to Putin.
Wasn't it something we've been discussing with you at the end of the last year?
Some may disagree with Putin, some may not like him, but the question is, who is able, who is ready to take responsibility? One thing is go to the streets, articulate your position, this is one thing, but such a vast country with such an immense gamut of problems, so far there's no any responsible leader who is able to say, yes, I am ready to run this country, and I am ready to spell out coherent development strategy.
Sergei, and remember we were saying that those, shall we say, leaders of the opposition are not coming up with any solutions. I mean, just claiming...
Well, they're smart, they're good speakers, but well, yes, they're lacking positive program.
They're lacking positive program. Some of them are smart and some of them are not. But saying that all those promises are just populism, I suppose it's not exactly to the point. I mean, well, of course there is a pre-election talk, and no one says anything. There shouldn't be a pre-election talk. But
getting back to the pledges, so to say,
yes,
I would not completely, so to say, fully agree with words like populism, pure and simple. I would rather see these pledges as a timely feedback to the ongoing street protests calling for fair elections. One of the key demands put forward by the opposition to Putin was to make the authorities respect citizens and their legitimate claims. I believe this may be a step in the right direction. The only question I forgot is why, for God's sake, haven't they solved some of these adding questions before, just to avoid making so many pledges at the same moment?
That's a good point.
People's anger is addressed to authorities, and the man at the top, if he's elected, will be Vladimir Putin. So he has to handle it somehow. He has to ensure the credibility of authorities will be not eroded.
Well, you know, I suppose that our bureaucrats need to be taught respect for the people. They need to be told that they're serving the people, that they're not benefiting from their high-level position. And this is crucial.
And a lot will depend on Mr. Putin. He has to send them a strong message that they're not immune in a democratic society.
Yes, precisely. But now, I suggest we could take a brief look into Kommersant publication. So, as far as I'm concerned, Putin, who is obviously running for a third term as president, has promised Russians a bigger say in politics. Is my understanding correct?
Yes, exactly.
And that's very important.
Do you need a quote?
Yes, sure.
Yes. That's what he wrote. We should give citizens an opportunity to form the lawmaking agenda on their own, to put forward their projects and articulate priorities. I propose setting up the rule of obligatory consideration of public initiatives, which will gather 100,000 and more signatures on the internet. So what's your position on that, Sergei?
Well, I was monitoring the responses to that, and the opposition leaders were quite enthusiastic with this. To put it in a nutshell, they said that this proposal is something which even exceeded their expectations. If it works, obviously.
Oh, really?
I think this initiative should be viewed positively. However, it will not work until, as the Prime Minister stressed it, that the mechanism of our democracy is renewed.
Well, I suppose that we still have a long way to go, but a long journey starts with the first step.
Exactly. It's one of my favorite, so to say, phrases.
That's an old Chinese saying.
Yeah.
And now we end this edition of Red Line, brought to you by the Voice of Russia Radio Service. It was presented by Sergei Strokin, Dmitry Polikarpov, and myself, Yekaterina Kudashkina. Thank you very much for staying with us. Goodbye and take care.
Take care and goodbye.
Take care and goodbye.
Redline has come to you in the World Service of the Voice of Russia.